Blog Talk Radio.
Well, folks, welcome to one more edition of Move to Amend. I just had my mic turned off. Thank you very much for spending one more hour with me on a Saturday. I know that your Saturday is precious, so we will make sure to move this along and move this along quickly. You know, this was a rough and busy week for me. I'm happy that it's all over after transferring 22 websites to a new server, changing my IMAP emails, which caused me to actually lose a whole bunch of emails. So in case you emailed me something and you didn't get a response, forgive me, it was in transition. And some of it actually likely got lost because I also transferred my Exchange server to Microsoft. Hopefully that will work better. Anyway, this week I attended a symposium in Houston that featured Dr. Gar Alperovitz. The topic of discussion was America Beyond Capitalism. The dialogue was intellectual yet applicable to everyday lives. Five of us weathered freezing rain and the cold that turned out to be a packed house. Actually, quite a few more people were there than even the most pessimistic of us actually believed. Well, folks, today's guest is the only, one and only, Dr. John J. Theiss. He's a professor of political science at Lone Star College and was the instigator that took us all to that symposium. We will discuss some of the topics covered. I hope to get input from the listeners. This should be a great show. But before we begin, I want to read it's the sneak preview of this week's Daily Coast front page that I do every week. It's going to be dropping this time at 6:30 Central Time on the front page. So take a look at it over there as well. And please make sure to comment and share this as well. Share the Daily Coast page with folks. Let them see what's going on. The other thing I want to ask people around here is please start sharing the shows. Remember, we want to have a material effect on people's lives in a positive direction. Remember also that what we're doing here is attempt folks know that they do matter. But here is the deal. Here's the piece that I wrote. It is titled, What is the Path to an American Beyond Capitalism? This week, millionaire investor and star of Shark Tank, Kevin O'Leary, said income inequality is a great thing because it inspires everybody to want to be like the 1%. He was responding to an Oxfam report that stated the world's richest 85 people had more wealth than half of the world's population. Is that he had no desire to think deeply about the meaning of a system where income inequality and wealth disparity was a systemic byproduct. Mr. O'Leary's thought process reflects the thought process of the current masters of capitalism. Any talking head on CNBC would articulate as much. Dr. Gaur Alperovitz, let me say that right, Dr. Gaur Alperovitz and David Benson visited the Roscoe Chapel for a discussion about capitalism last night. That means Thursday night. Dr. Gaur Alperovitz is a professor of political economics at the University of Maryland, co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative, and a past legislative director in the House and the Senate. He's a leading theorist in the movement to democratize wealth and build a new, more sustainable, and more community-focused economy. Dr. Gaur Alperovitz included some discussion on his new book, What Then Must We Do About the Next American Revolution? David Benson is the Director of Program and Special Projects in the Office of the Commissioner in Harris County, Precinct 1. Both of these men are real liberals, real progressives. Both were well-read. Dr. Gaur Alperovitz was the featured speaker, though David Benson seemed to connect more with the realities on the ground. Dr. Gaur Alperovitz stated that socialism, defined by him as state ownership of all means of production, and today's capitalism has failed the average human being. After all, he said, the Soviet-type economies desperately failed, and America's economy is failing many. The answer to what comes after today's capitalism is somewhere in between, he says. David Benson, who works on the ground with real people, the indigent, people looking for jobs, people underemployed, believes that a societal change based on a new economy is necessary, but necessary now. He alluded to Americans being conditioned to be silent sufferers. There is a pent-up demand for change that can only come with upheaval of the masses. He provided examples of the type of suffering in Harris County, Texas. These apply throughout the entire country. Harris County farms out its jails population because public and private entities have a vested interest in keeping them filled. Communities housing them become feedstocks to imprison for that purpose. David Benson also presented solutions being implemented in his precinct now while some transition occurs. He talks about partnering with local businesses to form public-private alliances to reuse material normally written off or food normally written off or discarded. Both men agreed that today's capitalism is responsible for the current income inequality and wealth disparity. They both alluded to the system being biased against the worker. Both believe that only through some hybrid of collective ownership of the means of production and therein employment can these disparities be mitigated. The first thing that was obvious was the contrast between two intellectuals based on how they view the effects of today's capitalism on the masses. Dr. Gaur Alperovitz, the author and academic, had great abstract ideas. He, however, could not express them in a manner that had a material effect on people's everyday lives. His approach is above the fray and somewhat ivory tower in what it does not provide, in that it does not provide marching orders, but more a la carte solutions without direction or bias. Mr. David Benson was not only a man that was working within the community, he was putting some of Dr. Gaur Alperovitz's concepts into action for his particular community. In doing so, he realized that a time will come where the coming change will not be as peaceful as Dr. Gaur Alperovitz alludes to. Mr. Benson is correct. The Oxfam report had the following conclusion. This massive concentration of economic resources in the hands of fewer people presents a significant threat to inclusive political and economic systems. Instead of moving forward together, people are increasingly separated. Power inevitably heightening social tensions and increasing the risk of societal breakdown. If one steps out of the ivory towers and examines the ups and downs of the Occupy Wall Street movement, it is evident that when the current order is threatened, the system reacts not as supposed democracy it is supposed to be, but the fascism that is today's capitalism. So folks, that is going to be dropping on Daily Coast tomorrow at about 6:30 Central Standard Time. But anyhow, Dr. Thijs, I don't know if you're in a position right now, but I'm about to go to you. I will be releasing your mic at this time. Dr. Thijs, welcome to Politics Done Right. How are you doing today, my friend?
I'm doing great, Egberto. How are you doing?
Well, so far, so good. First of all, I want to thank you for turning me on to that that symposium. That was actually a great learning experience for me. I know it wasn't much of a learning experience for you, but you had four other folks on the card. I think it was very, very much so.
I wouldn't have gone if it wasn't a learning experience. So I've read some of Gar Alperovitz's books, but I've never met him and been able to talk to him. So it was a real pleasure to do that.
Yeah, so did you get a chance to speak to him? I noticed when we went to the book sign-in that you were in there, did you get a chance to actually speak to him some or not?
Yeah, just briefly. There were a lot of people there, so I didn't want to take up too much time.
Yeah, that is excellent. Now, what do you think about what I had to say contrasting, let's say, the activist versus the academic in sort of a way?
Well, I mean, as you know, I sort of try to span the two worlds, doing activism and being an academic. I think what you'll find in his, some of his writings, like his latest book, What Must We Do Now, he has a little more concrete sort of steps that people can take. But I think you're largely right that he was looking at it from a broader historical and theoretical perspective. Now, I don't happen to agree that there has to be violence. I think there can be evolutionary changes in the capitalist system that gets us to something beyond capitalism. Violence is certainly a possibility at some point.
Yeah, I think what – I don't think Mr. Benson, David Benson, was really saying that it would be violence from the people. I think he more was alluding to it being a violent reaction from the powers that be. In effect, I think the attack on the Occupy movement in certain cities is probative. And if you notice, that really didn't even have a political party component. It was just the system, at least in my opinion, it was just the system. And by the way, 210, I think it's John, I'm coming to you next as well. I think it was the entire system coming together to say, we're not going to allow this to start. That's why I ended my little statement saying, what did I say? If one steps out of the ivory towers and examines the ups and downs on the Occupy Wall Street movement, it is evident that when the current order is threatened, the system reacts not as the supposed democracy it is supposed to be, but the fascism that it is today, capitalism.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Occupy was largely met by violence, not because it was violent, but because the system felt threatened. I think
right.
It's important to look. Most highly unequal societies are extremely repressive.
Right.
And one of the, you know, the World Economic Forum in Davos, one of the things they were talking about this year is inequality and what to do about it. All the statistics show inequality is not a good thing. It does not make a good society to live in. From mental illness, prison population, life expectancy, infant mortality, unequal societies are much worse. And in almost every measure that we would use to designate what makes a society a good place to live. So that's a concern. And, you know, I think the guy you were talking about on Shark Tank, that guy's just not very bright. He may have made a lot of money, but he doesn't know what he's talking about.
You know, Doc, I'm going to go to 210 next, but I want to make a statement. A few months ago, I wrote an article, and I don't remember the exact title, but it had to do with what are you worth, right? Because, you know, in our current society, we pay the janitor peons, we pay the garbage men, except if you were in New York, of course, pennies. But that guy who really couldn't sustain himself but knows how to sell one stock or another somehow makes orders of magnitude more than most. How do we define worth? I think in a lot of ways, we have to educate people to be worthy, to understand their real worth to society, that in effect, they're the ones that are contributing to society, not these, not the capitalists that think they are the ones. What do you see?
Well, yeah, I think you're right, and I'm glad you brought up that point, because there's a couple things that people may want to think about. I mean, first of all, you know, CEOs of corporations, they basically set their own pay. And, of
right.
course, if we let janitors set their own pay, they'd be making a lot more. So, in a sense, if we were to set CEO pay in the same way the janitor's pay is set, we would let the janitors set the CEO pay and let the CEO set the janitor's pay. But the other thing, you know, on the right, they talk about the market sets wage rates. And minimum wage and those kinds of things are a violation of market equilibrium. But in fact, economic theory assumes that wages are simply another labor is simply another commodity that conforms to the same supply and demand curves of any other commodity. Yet they don't, because people are limited in the amount of time they can work. They're limited to a maximum of 24 hours. Whereas any other commodity is not limited in the same way. So, in fact, there's an argument to be made that as wage rates go up, people will actually work less, which means supply will go down as the price goes up. This is opposite standard economic theory. And once you realize that, then there is no equilibrium wage. All wages are artificial. That's something for people to think about. It turns economic theory on its head with regards to market equilibrium wages for labor. So,
Dr. Tsai, that is a very important concept, and I don't know if it got over. So, you know, this is, we actually were discussing that in the car on the way back from the symposium. So, I mean, kind of explain it the way that you were talking about it in the car with respect to, well, if you make more money, what are you likely to do?
Well, we each have 24 hours in a day that we can decide what we want to do with, whether it's leisure, work, sleep, et cetera. Okay? And we have to make the trade-off. And the argument in neoclassical economics is that if wage rates go up, people will choose to work more so they can, because they are being paid more for that time. But in fact, the argument can more credibly, I think, be made that if wage rates go up, we will actually choose to work less, because now we're getting paid more for our work. We have more money to use on our leisure, and we would like to enjoy that leisure time. So I think there's very few people that would work a second job if they made twice as much money as they do today. You know, so you hear about these people working at KFC and then taking a second job at McDonald's to make ends meet. Well, if they were paid twice as much at KFC, they probably wouldn't take that second job at McDonald's. That means
right.
the supply of labor as wages go up would go down. And
exactly.
that's really the important thing to understand. So, and that's not what neoclassical economics says should happen. When the price of something goes up, which is wages of labor, the supply should go up. And that's the only way you can reach a market equilibrium, because the demand for labor will go down as it goes up.
Right.
But if the supply also goes down, those lines never intersect.
that is extremely important, and I think that actually lends itself to talk about, then we really need to ensure that we have the living wage. We really need to ensure or note that we should really have more control on wages than delegating it to some artificial market.
Exactly. And it has all sorts of corollary sort of conclusions that you can draw from that. Because if people made more, they'd work less, there would be fewer people looking for jobs because there would be more jobs out there since people aren't working two and three jobs. Or we may choose to work 30 hours a week instead of 48, which is what most Americans end up working now. Well, if you work, which in fact what happens in Europe, Europeans work 20% fewer hours than they did in 1980. We work 20% more because our wages haven't kept up.
Right.
So if people work less hours, that's more jobs for people that don't have them right now. So it would move us towards full employment if wages increase.
Right. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. You know, Doc, let me bring in John. He's one of our regular callers that really keeps well read. John, come on in, my friend.
Hey, Berto. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Dr. Theis.
Hey, John.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Mr. Alperovitz said. I when you put the who you're going to talk about on your blog, I spent a few hours reading about him, but especially the point about co-ops. That seems to be his main point that he's pushing, is that, you know, people can form these co-ops, and it isn't necessarily part of the capitalist system. It isn't part of the socialist system. Now, I think that, you know, co-ops are actually, very similar to a capitalist system. The only difference is that you have ownership by a wide variety of people, as opposed to a smaller number in a more traditional capitalist sense. But, I mean, I think his ideas are definitely well taken. But I think some of the language that he uses are very self-defeating, especially in the society that we live in, that really it is important when you talk about framing an issue. And so, in other words, when you talk about the end of capitalism, you're automatically turning off a tremendous amount of the population in America. They're just saying, I don't want to hear that. And so, I mean, that's one problem right there. And also, when he's talking about state socialism, I really think he's underestimating the degree that, especially in the democratic social, Scandinavian states, the success of socialism in those states. I mean, I think that people are incredibly happy. They have a great lifestyle. All the health care, which is, it's getting worse, but, I mean, it's still much better than the rest of the world. And also the education opportunities are much better. So I think he's kind of making a mistake, and I also think that he's making a mistake. We talked about this before a couple of months ago about the Sharma Savant, who was the latest socialist who was elected into the Seattle City Council.
Right.
And I think that she's making a similar mistake when they're discounting capitalism, and it's kind of like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think that both of these systems were actually fairly successful. I mean, socialism has been successful in the Scandinavian countries, and the form of capitalism that happened from World War II to the trickle-down era was also mostly successful. I mean, we didn't have income inequality like we have now, and that's because the tax rates were higher for the upper class and even more for the middle class. I mean, we didn't have tax phobia back then. We believed that we were our brother's keeper, and we believed in the social contract. And that has gone away, and that has been, I think, one of the biggest problems in the American society and also in the world. Because, you know, if you look at even European Union rates from 10 years ago, they dropped about 10%. I mean, even in the Scandinavian countries. And so, you know, this neoliberal push that has gone on is slowly, you know, taking over. And so I don't know if the best way to address that is just to say, you know, capitalism is a failure, and we don't like state socialism either, and everything should be put into co-ops. That just seems like, you know, it could work in the long run, and I really do believe in co-ops, and I hope that they are successful. But it just seems like a very long-term strategy, and I want to hear your comments on this.
Doctor?
Well, I think you make some really good points, John. I would say a couple things. One is that when he talks about state socialism, and this was a question that was actually asked at the talk, he's really referring to sort of the Soviet Union communist sort of version of state socialism where the government owns everything. I think in some ways it's sort of a straw man. At the other extreme is what he calls corporate capitalism, which is what's in place in the U.S. today. I think for Alperovitz, the key is that economic power determines political power. And if you really believe in democracy, you've got to make sure economic power is as dispersed as possible, that the people who are the citizens have economic power. And corporate capitalism, he talked about that a little bit, and he said, look, the problem that we have with corporate capitalism is that the model that liberals have been working with is that we use the state to regulate corporations. And Richard Wolff, who's an economist at University of Massachusetts Amherst, talked about this quite a bit. And he said, look, the problem with regulation is the people that are being regulated have all the resources to seek to undo those regulations because they're the ones running the companies. And they're going to use those resources to try and evade, change people's opinion, undo the regulations that hamstring them. And so Wolff also argues for a different model. Now, Alperovitz, cooperatives are the primary thing that is out there as an alternative. He also talked about public corporations, land trusts as alternatives. So he had about three or four different things that he talked about. Clearly, cooperatives are the primary thing that are out there that sort of democratize economic power. But I think he was very clear, and he would say that if you asked him, that he doesn't know what the future holds. I tend to agree with him that I think the key is to try out and experiment with different ways of democratizing economic power. Democratic socialism, I think, clearly is something that works. And I was talking to one of my friends who's a democratic socialist, and he said Alperovitz is making a tactical decision not to say socialism because socialism gets associated with the Soviet Union. But I think we have a lot to learn from some of the European countries. Unfortunately, a number of them are moving away from that model. And that's sort of concerning to me. But it's very clear Europeans are much happier in their society. They live better. They have better health. They have better life expectancy, fewer health problems, lower infant mortality, less stress, less mental illness, et cetera. So there's something to be commended in what they're doing.
That is true. Now, do you want to respond to that, John?
No, I think it's absolutely right what he was saying. I do think that, you know, if he's going to make a statement, because, you know, on one of the, I guess it was a podcast that he was mentioning the communist system. And I think it is important that the language, you know, is that you, if you say that socialist and you mean communist, it really kind of distorts what you mean. You know, because, you know, in my view, you know, socialism, the European style, like I said, the Scandinavian style of socialism where you have, you know, high union rates. And I think that's one of the – another issue that helps inequality. When people are union, I mean, if you look at the union rates of people in Denmark, 68.5%, Sweden, 68.9%, Finland, 69%, and Norway, 54.6%. Of course, people are going to make more money. And that's subsidized by the higher taxes. And I think that people, you know, like I said, enjoy that system more. I think what Ms. Savant is doing is also kind of, she's going back to the communist system, and like she wants to kind of like she was talking about you know, if the Boeing people leave to go to another state, that they should take over, you know, where their headquarters are. And it's more of a radical system, and it's also kind of praising, like, the Mao Revolution and praising when Castro took over. And I think that most people consider that, just like Mr. Alperovitz says, that is a failed system. And so we need to get some kind of hybrid. And I agree with what he's saying. I just wish he would be a little bit more specific. Now, some of the things that I've heard him talk about, like he was saying that instead of breaking up the too big to fail banks, that we should just nationalize the banks, which is, you know, more of a, I mean, that is more in line with a socialist or even a, you know, even a communist you know, state of mind, having nationalized banks. Even most of the Scandinavian countries don't have nationalized banks. I mean, the Swedish banks were nationalized for a short period, and then they were returned back to individual ownership. And so, you know, it seems to me that there's a little bit of a contradiction going on here. And so that's, you know, I think that he's definitely a very intelligent man, but some of the language, I don't know if he's really helping his cause. And so that's a little bit of my take on it.
Folks, the number is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. If you want to speak to Dr. Theis, just press 1. Or if you want to add something to the discussion, press 1 and let's talk. Now, I mean, Dr. Theis, I think John brought up an interesting thing, and we spoke about that, and in fact, you sent me a paper that I haven't yet read about it, and it has to do with Smith, the father of capitalism, if you will, and what he thought about unions, what he thought about education. Why not give us a rundown on that from this specific narrative, that those are the masters of capitalism right now are failing us in that they're not doing the necessary steps to really keep it going forward, because they've negated to follow what Smith have actually stated as well.
Well, I would say two things. One, corporate capitalism may actually be doing exactly what the early critics of capitalism said would happen. I mean, or not even early. I mean, if you read Carl Polanyi, who wrote The Great Transformation, he talks about how capitalism, when everything is commodified and a price is put on it, capitalism will end up consuming itself. We may actually be heading in the direction that critics of capitalism have long said we'd head. But John was absolutely right in pointing out the importance of unions, in the 1960s, we had 30, I think late 1950s, we had almost 38% of Americans in unions. We're
right.
down to 11% total and 6% of the private sector. And then the result is workers have no bargaining power. Well, this is exactly what Adam Smith talked about when he wrote The Wealth of Nations. He talked about, and also in his other book, The Moral Sense, he talked about workers, because there are so many workers, not having the ability to bargain with the owners of capital in this, on a level playing field. It's easier for the owners of capital to collude because there's fewer of them. That's simply a collective action issue. It's also easier for owners of capital to wait out the workers because capital doesn't need to eat, in a sense, whereas workers do. So if workers go on strike, then the owners can always just wait them out till the workers have no choice but to come back to work because they can't pay their bills.
Right.
And Smith actually said any time government takes actions in disputes between workers and owners, they should always side on the side of workers because workers are inherently disadvantaged. And that's something that our government today has forgotten about.
Right. Exactly. Now, also, you had mentioned about what he had to say with regards to education as well.
Well, Smith called for public education, a public school system, and wanted it to be free.
And why did he want that?
Well, it improves the workforce, and it gives everybody a better ability to reason and be rational and know their own interests.
So in effect, it's the same thing that we are doing right now. When we start to have policies that actually try to dictate that we want to improve infrastructure, we want to improve education, in effect, we're not following some those policies that we're attempting to follow right now are really not some socialist want to give away to people or anything type of a policy. It is simply a policy that is actually in line with what the original intent of capitalism was supposed to be. Isn't that true?
Yeah, I would say Adam Smith has a lot more in common with progressives today than it does with the right wing and people like Ayn Rand. I mean, Ayn Rand was not, despite people thinking she's just a continuation of Smith, is not. And in fact, Adam Smith talked about the need to regulate monopolies and have their public purpose because monopolies restrict competition. And I think this is something we have to remember in a capitalist system. A company has no desire to compete in a perfectly competitive market. Their goals are always to move towards monopoly or oligopoly and eliminate competition, because only then can they maximize their profits. Smith was writing, in a sense, when Smith talked about a market, he was talking about an actual market where consumers would go and we get to look at the apples that vendor A is selling and the apples vendor B is selling and the apples vendor C is selling and make a determination on which apple we wanted based on price, based on the brown spots, etc. He wasn't talking about some ephemeral marketplace that never existed. I mean, that was implicit in it, but that wasn't sort of the focus. And I think we have to remember, we have very few of those places where we can go compare the products of different producers. In fact, our society is designed not to allow us to do that very easily.
In what way would you say that, Doc?
Well, I've always wondered why we don't have a big auto mall that has on one floor Chevys, on one floor Fords, on one floor Dodges, on one floor Nissans, on one floor Toyotas, another floor Mazdas, another floor BMWs, and we could go between floors and compare the kinds of cars we want. That would be a market.
Right, right.
Another market is the...
Go ahead, John.
Go from dealer to dealer to dealer.
Okay, right. I see what you're saying.
Another market is that is similar is the hospitals. You know, you have this is one of the things that hopefully the PPACA will address is that I mean they've already addressed it a little bit. Did you have like let's say somebody wants an appendectomy or has to have an appendectomy? I don't know. I guess it's been about a year, 6 months ago. They did a study of all of the different hospitals, not all of them, but several of the hospitals across the country, and the prices just varied incredibly widely. And you have no idea what the prices are. Now, if you want an appendectomy, you got to get that done right away. But, I mean,
right.
Something else that, something that would be more selective surgery, I mean, you should know what these things cost. I mean, why does the hospital, get this non-transparency? You don't know what the bill is until you actually get it,
No.
And it.
John,
but, I mean,
you're
that's
absolutely like, correct. One of the examples I use in my class. See, for markets to work, there are certain assumptions that are made. One of them is complete information. When we buy a car, go around and try to get as much information as we could. Think if we walked into a dealer and said, I'll take the red car, send me a bill. We all know what would happen. Yet that's essentially the way we buy healthcare. And it's not just prices across the country. There was a study done here in Houston and found across the city there was as much as 300% difference in basic healthcare services in the price of it. And when we get in a car wreck, we don't sit down and compare the prices of ambulances. They just send us one and bill us. And our healthcare system is the most expensive in the world. Go figure.
We repeat those stats ad nauseum, and somehow we don't get them through as we should. I don't know. What is it going to take for us to be, or what narrative must we come up with to really sort of articulate this to folks? Because I think we need some help here. What do you think, Dad?
What do I think we need to do to articulate these arguments?
In a narrative that actually penetrates.
Well, I mean, that's a huge question. Who controls our narrative now?
The traditional media.
The traditional media. And the traditional media is owned by the very same corporate interests that like the narrative as it is.
Right.
Ultimately, and I mean, I happen to agree with Alberovitz. When you look historically, I mean, I doubt a lot of people thought feudalism was going to end, but it did. Capitalism is going to end at some point. The question is what replaces it, we don't know. But to have these discussions, the biggest thing is we've got to get the ability of money to affect our discourse, to affect our politics out. That's why I like working with Move to Amend,
Right. Now, let me ask you one. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I think our media ought to be publicly owned, serving a public purpose. After all, they are public airwaves that are being used.
Exactly. Now, it is interesting that you brought up Move to Amend because a lot of the different tactics that we are using at Move to Amend is quite a bit different than the other organizations that are actually working on amending the Constitution to codify that money is not speech and corporation is not a person. We actually strongly believe that with that constitutional amendment, it has to be much more. One must educate people into how a system works, how the politics work, how all these items tying around, because you get a constitutional amendment that finally say these things and taking money out of politics, etc., what do you have then? If you still have the same population that remains, I don't want to say uneducated for sound, because it may sound sort of wrong to say that, but people that are not well aware of how things work, one has to begin that education. And that is the kind of things that we do here at Coffee Party in having these radio shows and having these other programs. We try our best to have a different voice than that voice you are going to continuously hear from this traditional media that has ulterior, what I like to call ulterior motives or ulterior methods. But for now, I need to do a quick pause and play our Coffee Party promo. So please bear with me for 1 second, guys.
Hello, everyone. This is John Cashin, host of the Coffee Party Radio Civics Minute. Did you know that the Coffee Party is funded by our listeners and fans, and not by the super PACs, think tanks, or by a super wealthy individual wanting to buy the American way? The Coffee Party USA is powered by the people and your passion to bring positive change to our country, but we need your help to continue. With just a small donation, you can help us continue bringing Americans together for a dialogue that attempts to bypass the normal partisan rhetoric that is so common today. The Coffee Party USA is striving to bring you original content from editorials, fact-checking, and video documentaries, while also working to bring you the latest information from all of the 535 congressional districts. No matter what party we may belong or what issues that we follow, one thing is always clear. We are all Americans. Please go to coffeepartyusa.nationbuilder.com/donate and donate what you can to help us move our country forward, united with one voice, E Pluribus Unum. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cash.
Well, we're back, Dr. Theis. On Tuesday next week at 9:30 a.m., I will be coming to your class. Why don't you tell our listeners what I am supposed to be coming back, what type of information I'm going to be coming back with, what will I learn?
What we're going to be doing is talking about Federalist Number 10, which was one of James Madison's probably most famous Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers were written to defend the Constitution, their series of essays, in New York newspapers, 1788 and 1789. And Federalist Number 10 is essentially talking about factions. And in it, Madison is concerned about the effect factions, or what we would call interest groups today, or political parties or unions or any sort of group of people. He defines it as a group of individuals that are united by a common impulse or passion that's adverse to the interests of the society or other members. So he's saying, how do we deal with these factions? And what's really interesting about that Federalist paper is he talks about what are factions, what causes them, and he says the most durable source of faction is the various and unequal distributions of property. And Madison, of course, was one of the ones with property. Most people that lived in the colonies did not have large amounts of property. And the concern Madison had was, how do you keep a majority from using the government to take the property of the few? So it's a really interesting thing. And what I think is really important, we hear people say government should not be involved in the economy. Government interferes with the economy, and we need to let the free market rule. What Madison said in Federalist 10 was that the principal purpose of legislation was to regulate economic interests, to regulate the economy.
And that's something that people don't even realize that he talked about, unless they've read Federalist 10.
Now, that throws the entire debate on its ear. One wonders why those who always quote these Federalist papers when they're making these let's call them right-wing attacks on those that would attempt to regulate the economy for the betterment of society, why is it that we don't have anyone, professors alike, going out vociferously, bringing out one of the bastions of our country, Madison, bring that out and let it be known?
Well, look, one of the reasons I like coming on your show is because you let me finish what I'm going to say. And if I take 15 minutes, you let me say it. Have you ever seen a network allow somebody to talk for 10, 15, 20 minutes to make their point?
Not really.
No, they don't. And that's the structure of the American media does not let you bring up things that it doesn't want you to talk about.
Right.
Because you only have 2 minutes or 3 minutes to bring up your side before they give it to the other side, and then it goes to commercial. You can't talk about things that aren't conventional wisdom when the media is structured that way.
Well, I tell you, Doc, that is one of the reasons we intend to continue with these types of programs where we can actually get folks to talk. And the next thing that I want to ask my audience to do is, those that are listening, make sure and share these shows. Share it with your friends and encourage them to listen. I've gone from 2 hours to 1 hour for one specific reason, to try to keep things tighter. And in keeping things tighter, I know people's time is precious, so they get a chance to say, okay, if they're going to be on the jogging machine or whatever, they get a chance to listen. Now, I have another call. It's coming in from Skype. You're hot, my friend. Who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Dr. John's a stick.
Doctor who? I guess that was a prank call. We get some of those every so often. But yes, folks, as I was mentioning before I attempted to get that user on, what we want to do is we want to have guests like Dr. Theis on that will get extended periods of time that they can articulate issues in such a manner that we all can understand. I can tell you one thing. I am a political activist, folks. I am not some learned economist or whatever. I took economics 101, macroeconomics, and I do a whole lot of reading. I met Dr. Theis, and we did occupy Kingwood for a whole, how many consecutive weeks, Dr. Theis? 52 consecutive 52 weeks, right?
52 consecutive weeks, yeah.
For a whole year, and we spent our time there engaged in strong dialogue and learning together, and also imparting that with a lot of folks that would pass by, initially many of them on the attack, some of them leaving with an open mind or willing to dialogue some more. That is what we are all about. That is what we attempt. 111, again, is back. Let's see if that's a real call. 111, can I help you? What's the, who do I have the honor of speaking with? You're hot. I guess that's what it's all about.
All right. Egberto.
Yes.
Yeah, let me just say that I think what Alperovitz has talked about, what I think is really important, that I don't think corporate America wants to think about, is how do we make our country more democratic, where
right.
we value individual contributions. And quite frankly, some of my best friends are Republicans, they're conservatives. That doesn't bother me. I consider myself a pragmatist. I want to see solutions that work, that solve the problems. If cutting taxes on the wealthy worked, I wouldn't have a problem with it.
Exactly.
We have 30 years of evidence that it doesn't work. That's my issue. But I want to see ways in which ordinary people have more control over their own lives, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's at their home, whether it's in the neighborhood. And that is democracy. And I think everybody on the left and the right should support more democracy.
Could not have said it any better, Dr. Theis. We are currently at the 4-minute mark. So what I'd like to do is have John give a closing statement. Then I'll ask you for a closing statement, and we'll say c'est la vie. So, John, come on in, my friend.
All right. Yeah, I just want to talk about a little bit what Dr. Theis was talking about. I mean, there was the Shays Rebellion, which was a tax revolt in Massachusetts, and there were other tax revolts that were, you know, put down by George Washington and his militia. So, I mean, this whole idea about, you know, taxation is theft, I mean, this is an extreme idea that has been around ever since the founding of our nation, and it was rejected, you know, by Washington that, you know, taxation is necessary. And I just wish people would accept the community idea a lot more, and that's what I really agree with Alperovitz, that he really wants to see that happen, and I hope it happens too. So I didn't mean to come down on him so much. I just wanted to clarify that, you know, there are a few things I didn't agree with them, but most of all, I think he is promoting a more democratic state, and I hope that happens. With Obama's State of the Union, I hope he does stress income inequality. I know I've heard that he may actually talk about more opportunity, which is also, you know, very important. But, you know, I think that I hope that somehow he can motivate people to get involved. It seems a little bit hypocritical when he's promoting things like the TPP, and that's a huge problem.
Exactly.
But,
I agree with you there.
But I hope he can motivate some people to come out and vote in the fall of 2014. Be involved and don't expect perfection, but try to do research and try to vote who you think is going to, you know, be the best thing for the country. I think, you know, it's in a non-election year, it's very important that people actually turn out.
John,
and this is going to be a big election.
John, thank you very much for those words, and thank you for the call. You are very important to this show in that you bring a whole lot of good narrative. So thank you very much. John, minute closing, my friend.
Let me just reiterate, I think it is important for everybody to vote. I think John's right on that, especially given what's happened, how our Congress is behaving. I think we should vote all those incumbents out. But I don't think it stops at that. I think we need to be calling our congresspeople. We need to be calling our city councilmen. We need to be going to neighborhood association meetings. We need to be out there on the corners, street corners, when there are issues that come up. We need to oppose things like the PPP in many different forums, in many different venues. We need to go to the town halls, the neighborhood associations, and we need to become democratic in all aspects of our life and participatory.
Well, John, Dr. Theis, thank you very much for being on the show. This was a class act. I think this is a show that a lot of people would want to hear, especially on the thoughts of Alperovitz and the other speaker. Folks, don't forget, please remember to go to coffeepartyusa.com and sign up to be a member. Please remember, we all do this on a volunteer basis and would love your donations to keep this thing going. Remember, we have five shows on Sundays at 3 p.m. We have Progressive Politics Tennessee Style with Bud Fields. On Mondays at 10 p.m. Eastern, we have Press One for Democracy with Dan Aronson. On Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, we have The Middle Ground with Eric Beiler. On Thursdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, we have Lunch with Loudon. And of course, on Saturdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 Central, you have Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time that you've been spending with us. Please remember, importantly, share our programs, because together we are the ones that are going to make that change. Dr. Theis, John, thank you very much. See you on Tuesday. Have a wonderful day, everybody. C'est la vie.
Thank you, Egberto.